You're listening to the Infinite Loopback Podcast, an Apple-themed technology podcast hosted by Brian Baggett, Jim Graham, and Brad Tarver. So it's March, and it's like freezing here in Atlanta. I don't know about you guys, but man, it is still cold.
It's in the 50s here in Mississippi. It's pretty nice.
50s in Texas. It was actually really nice yesterday. It got up yesterday morning, and it was chilly, but it warmed up pretty fast and ended up with the doors open. Just a beautiful day in the suburbs here in Dallas.
All right. Well, let's get started, see what's happened this week. So there's a lot of things going on. The big news and the rumor mill is that the next iPhone. First, we heard, it's going to switch to USB-C. And of course, that seemed sort of patently ridiculous.
Which nobody actually believed, right?
Well, I don't know. There's people out there that would be thrilled by that. And of course, the MacBooks have the USB-C connectors. But it seemed, you know, as Gruber pointed out, last year they make all these headphones, all these earbuds that have lightning connectors. And then the next year they completely ditch it. That would be ridiculous even by Apple standards. It looks like what we're getting is that the cable is going to be lightning on one end and USB-C on the other. So it'll be similar to the 2015 MacBook charger and how we use it on our iPads so that we can get the fast charging. What do you guys think about this?
I think I already have one of those cables just so I can connect my current iPhone to my new MacBook. So that's not really a thing for me.
I have a couple of those cables because I already had one to fast charge my iPad. Then I bought that was like the 3-foot one that I bought. And then I bought the one meter for a new MacBook to charge my phone or iPad. So I'm all for USB-C. When I saw the announcement, you know, I was like, that would be awesome. I didn't for a second believe that would happen, but I was like, yeah, that's awesome. So I think this is at least some middle ground. The question I've got is, what do you put in the box now? Because 90, I don't even want to say 95%. It's 98 or 99% of the people who are going to buy an iPhone still are not going to have a laptop that doesn't have a USB-C port. And Brian, I know you and I talked earlier this week that you shouldn't be plugging your phone into your laptop anyway, for the most part. That, you know, you charge it via a charger and you sync it over Wi-Fi. And the only time you really need to plug it into your laptop is if you're away from a charger and you need a charge, you know, like say I'm on site working or something and I just want to plug it in for a quick charge. But that should be the exception, not the rule. Hopefully they put the USB-C to Lightning cable in the box and those actually get more popular, because right now, as far as I know, the only place you can buy that cable is from Apple. I haven't seen Anker making them. I haven't seen Aukey making them. The only place I have seen USB-C to Lightning is Apple. That's it. And they're expensive.
They'll start boxing the iPhone with a USB-C to audio jack dongle and a USB-A to USB-C dongle. They'll start shipping the phone with like three dongles or something. Or they'll just make you buy the three dongles sold separately, sort of like you had to do with the MacBook. So it's like, if you want to use this phone, you have to buy dongles. I was totally kidding, by the way. But it's still a funny concept to me.
Actually, I would disagree with that. So... It is a funny concept, but I will say, if that is true, that Apple is the only one making that cable, you'll see in short order, Monoprice, Amazon, whoever, they'll crank them out.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, but that's the only, because I looked, because I wanted to buy a second one, and I didn't want to pay Apple prices. They don't exist besides at Apple.
Well, people will jump on that MFI branding just so that they can, or the MFI logo or whatever, so that they can sell their legit cable and still make a little money and pay a little license.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that'll happen, but honestly, we are old people. We are nerds. We are edge cases, and it's easy to forget that we are not the norm in this particular situation. Normal people don't plug their phones into their computers with any regularity. They just don't. And moreover, you don't have a need to do so anymore, because everything you have does over the air. The upgrades, the activation with your carrier, iCloud backups, everything is designed to not need a computer to be able to do this. So this is, you know, when they removed the headphone jack, I could kind of see.
And they did that back with like iOS 7, where you didn't really need to connect to a computer anymore.
Yeah, it's been 3 or 4 years.
You know, Brian, I'm going to disagree with you there. I think we're the edge case in the other direction. We don't plug it into our laptops because we know how to set up the Wi-Fi backup and we know how to set up all these things. I think normal people are still plugging it into their laptops like they always did. That's what I see at work. That's what I see when I go to people's houses. They're plugging it into the front of their tower desktops or their laptops. Now, given there might be a charge block in the kitchen wall where they'll go plug things in, but in general, people go plug their phones into their computers, where I've seen.
I don't see that at all. I look at people like my parents, my brother. I'm talking about non-technical people. If you're working with other technical people and they're doing it, well, guess what? They're the edge case too. They sell millions upon millions of iPhones a quarter. I can guarantee you that's not the case. When you go and you set up a new iPhone, at no point is it telling you to plug into your Mac in most cases. It prompts you for your iCloud password. It prompts you for your Wi-Fi password, and you're off to the races. Like, if people do it because it's learned behavior, that's fine, but there is no reason for them to do it normally.
Well, I agree that there's no reason for him to do it. Like I said, it should be the exception, not the rule, that you just happen to be someplace without a block charger or something to plug in a wall, so you plug it into your laptop to get a little, you know, a little hit of some power. But I still, you know, I think it's done just because people are used to it. So that's why I wonder, you know, about them putting a USB-C to Lightning cable in the box, because it won't plug into at least 95% of the computers that people have out there. But it'll, you know, and also everybody will have to get new power blocks. Like, every power block that they've had, how many of those, okay, I mean, again, this is where we're the edge case, but how many of those little white Apple power blocks do you have that you totally don't use? Because I've bought, you know, multi-chargers or batteries that I plug into. Like, I've got a Tupperware container full of those little white blocks. And as soon as they start shipping Lightning to USB, every one of those little white blocks is obsoleted.
Or a surge protector that has USB 5 amp on it. We've been through so many iPads at our house, and you can basically use an iPad charger as a fast charge for your phone. We don't even use the block that comes with our phones anymore. We just all have our own little iPad charger now in the house.
Yeah, I threw away those 5 watts forever ago.
It's a backup for sure, but...
Those iPad charges are like, those are like the gold standard. You don't want to lose those. Those are the ones everybody's fighting over.
Yeah, I throw those little 5-watt iPhone chargers away all the time. That is the most compelling reason that they might include a dongle, but I don't think that they will, because I don't think that they're concerned with it. They wouldn't do it for plugging into your computer. They don't care about that, and I don't blame them. There's no need to do that in most cases. They're not worried about PC users that have to plug in. Now, the problem that you would have in that particular case is if you brick it somehow and you're in DFU mode, you're going to need to get that into your computer to be able to get it back to the way it's supposed to be. So, you know, there are some times that you would do it.
Most people are going to go into an Apple store for that anyway. They're not going to do it on their own, right?
That's a fair point. But, you know, I have this behind me here that is just out of sight. And I have those little Anchor, you know, 10 jack USB-A 60 watt bricks that I plug everything into to charge it. So I'm not saying that I won't be going out and getting USB-C to USB-A. I'm certain that I will. But I don't think that... I think the benefit of the fast charging is going to negate a lot of people. It should salve over that wound pretty well. I keep my MacBook charger, the one that we're talking about, the 18 watt that does the fast charging. I keep that plugged in centrally in my house, and I'll plug all sorts of things in at my phone. I know it doesn't do fast charging, but even though I have a power brick that's like a few feet away, that's a fast place that I can charge my iPad. And you know what? It'll be worth it. If I have to go out and buy a handful of monoprice USB-A to USB-C dongles, little adapters, I'll certainly do it. The question is, if I do that, will I lose the benefit of the fast charging? And if I have to do that, then I'm going to have to go out and buy a whole bunch of 18-watt chargers then, I guess.
I actually find this Christmas, when they put one on sale, I'm not sure if it was an Anker or Aukey, but I bought a 30,000, milliamp battery, like a brick, that has a USB-C plug on it. It has a regular USB, what do you call those, type 2 plug? I'm not sure. And then it also has a micro USB, so I can charge the block via the micro or the USB-C, and then the USB-C one goes both ways. I can plug my devices into it. So that's been real handy to keep in my laptop bag, that block that does a little bit of everything. Now, if it would just charge my laptop, that's the one thing that doesn't do. I tried that to just see if it could deliver enough power to just give my laptop just a little bit of juice, and it won't charge the laptop at all. So boo.
When Apple moves to a standard, other companies will rush and make accessories to fill that need, even if Apples are expensive. Am I looking forward to replacing the charger, the thing that goes in my lighter in my car to be able to charge my phone off of it? No, I'm really not. But if that's what I have to do, then that's what I have to do. And you know, it's progress. It moves forward. And
they're finally putting USB plugs in cars after 10 years after they should have done it. And pretty soon we're going to switch you to a different USB. That is so funny.
Or you just hang on to that old cable, your old A to C, A to Lightning cable.
A lot of people end up doing that, but it just seems weird to me that we can't be forward thinking enough where we design something that's going to last and have some future proofing in it. You know, and imagine if we had to change the wall sockets in our house for the power. I mean, that it's that type of ridiculousness. It's like, stop doing this.
Like if Russia takes over our whole country and makes a switch to European plugs, you mean?
That look like puzzle pieces, yes.
They do, don't they? So I want to talk about the one other rumor that came out when they talked about the USB-C rumor that I was just drooling over is an iPhone with the OLED display that's almost as big as a plus screen, but the form factor closer to the regular phone because there's no edges at all. Like it's all screen. That would be the most amazing iPhone ever. OLED display, no bezel, huge screen, but not as big for your hand or pocket. That would just be amazing.
I think it's just a matter of when more so than if, Jim. I think it's coming.
I'd be very surprised if we didn't see it in the fall. And I would love to see that bezel and the Touch ID get integrated into the screen.
I love the plus screen. I want that big screen. I increase the font size on mine now. I want the bigger screen for everything that it gives you. It's just holding the thing is too big for my hands to be able to type on it one-handed. And I like to be able to do that. For as far as pocketability, I can throw it in a back pocket still. But yeah. I want a plus for every reason except that it's that big. I mean, the camera is great, the big screen. It's just the form factor is like the top of the list of, damn it, I want the big screen without the big screen.
Pop in your AirPods and use some dictation. Use Siri to dictate stuff instead of worrying about typing all the time, Grandpa.
Well, I think I'm going to switch this time no matter what and just deal with it. And if I don't like it again, like you said before, I'm going to have a new phone in a year. So
I had the 6 Plus. I went to the 6S and I'm back to the 7 Plus. And I've gotten so used to it now that I don't really care. Sometimes it is unwieldy. I mean, sometimes it is sort of cumbersome, but more often than not, for 90% of the situations that I'm in, it's fine. And I could be on a plane and I can watch it instead of my iPad and the video, that 1080p looks really sweet and it doesn't take up as much space. So, you know, if they end up doing, you know, we've heard there's going to be 3 models of iPhones potentially with like a 7S and a 7S Plus and some sort of premium third option. And that might be the one that gets rid of the bezels. You know, that might be an interesting thing too. If you could take the number of pixels and the screen size of the 7 Plus and put it in the form factor of a 7, I would probably do that one in a heartbeat. But if that doesn't exist, if it turns out to be bogus, I'll stick with, you know, the 7S Plus or 8S or whatever they're going to, I mean, 8 Plus, whatever they're going to call it, and be fine with that.
It'd be kind of cool if they did the OLED screen that, you know, did edge to edge and then added the iPad keyboard dock, the little three pin deal, so you could have a large iPhone screen to type on. No, is that totally way out there?
I don't see myself typing on my phone. I'll sometimes bond a Bluetooth keyboard in a pinch if I really need it, if I'm going to type something that's long form and all I have on me is my phone, but I probably wouldn't use it that often, to be honest. And then you'd have to make it...
Because I've got the iPad Pro. Right. If I didn't have that at all, then I might could use the phone. And
well, I guess what I was getting at was like, what if you didn't have an iPad and you bought you wanted to have kind of that one and all-in-one device? You could be, say, a sales guy, fly from one coast to another, and all you've got in your pocket is a keyboard and a giant iPhone. You know, you could take it to meetings or whatever and take notes. And
is that a keyboard in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
Am I way off here?
To have a keyboard that would have the right form factor to give you a comfortable typing experience is still going to be so much bigger than the phone that it would look kind of comical to have a full-size keyboard and a tiny little device that you're sitting there sort of looking on and typing.
Well, you know, what if it was kind of like the keyboard they have now where it has that fabric touch, but it's sort of tri-folded across the keys so that it folded up to be as small as the length and width, but you fold it out, say like a tri-fold, and put your phone on it and go.
They used to have those in the Palm PC days, by the way, those fold-out keyboards that you could do. And I mean, it's not really a new concept.
I remember those.
I mean, personally, I don't think I would use it. What about you, Jim?
I don't know if y'all thought this, but I thought that there would be more peripherals released. Some Mississippi coming out of me there, sorry. That use that little keyboard magnetic plug on the iPad Pro models. I really thought there would be more things that came out to use that. But as far as I know, it's kind of the Apple keyboard, and then Logitech makes keyboards, and there might be some other third parties. But really, it's only been used for keyboards. I really thought there might be more input things.
Does the Logitech keyboard use that port?
Yes. As far as I know, the Logitech one does too. Brian, are you looking that up, or is it Bluetooth?
I see the wheels turning. Research.
I saw like this blink in his face on the we're on video here. As the listener, you should be glad that you just get to listen to us and don't have to listen look at us three ugly guys. So, but yes, I saw this look on Brian's face like, oh no, surely not.
It does use the smart connector, so I did just verify that it does. What would you imagine would use that? Because besides keyboards and the way that it's placed on the iPad, I don't know what else you would put there instead or in addition to a keyboard or instead of a keyboard. What would you attach?
A gaming surface?
Yeah, a game surface or an additional touchpad that, you know, that can connect to it, or a game controller that you could connect to it. I don't know what the data rate is for that plug. So it may be that typing is obviously a very slow data rate. Even if you're typing super fast, that's not a lot of data at all going through that port. So it may be that it's just not designed to handle a very high throughput of data. I guess for like a docking station that you would plug into, you would just use the lightning port to transfer, you know, like docking for music and stuff. But it would be nice if you could just have a docking station to just set it down on and it just automatically, you know, picked up. And I know there are other things, you know, there, like I said, there's a lightning port and you got Bluetooth and you got AirPlay. I don't know. It just seems like if Apple puts a plug on something, somebody's going to figure out something to put on Kickstarter to try to sell somebody to use that plug, right?
I don't think the future is plugs with Apple. So that's the other thing too. I mean, you talk about the gaming controllers. They've had the Bluetooth controllers that look like Xbox controllers forever. I have one. Not enough games actually support the MFI for the controller to make it really worthwhile. And in a lot of cases, right? I love it. There's a site called Afterpad that I go to that shows me all of the games that support it. Whenever I try to play a game and it doesn't support it, I'm deeply irritated. But Bluetooth is more than fine for that. I'm trying to think of what else would be.
I would love, in my ideal situation, there would be a console quality Madden game, like, and it doesn't have to be like Xbox One console quality. It could be like original Xbox console quality, which I still think the iPad could do much better than that, where I could connect a controller and play those games. But the way they design those games now, they're iPad specific for touches and things like that. They're not really designed for a controller. So to me, when you do try to play them with a controller, it's not near as good as just, hey, you've got to have a... Are there any iOS games? I can't think of any. I mean, given I'm not a huge gamer, that are, you can't play this iOS game without a controller, or either it's just not near as good if you don't have a controller.
You know, a good example of that is Knights of the Old Republic. They have ported that over to iOS, and I loved playing that on the PC. And granted, we're talking about keyboard and mouse control, but you could use a game controller with it. But I downloaded the iOS version, and it's so kludgy trying to navigate around in the hallways and the ships and stuff and trying to engage in attacks or whatever, because you have to be able to touch so many things, whereas it'd be nice to just have a quick button that your finger's already on to be able to manipulate. So that's my use case.
Well, to answer your question, I think there's a requirement from Apple that says you can't make a controller-only game for those devices. So consider the Apple TV. There's plenty of those games. And, you know, I think they may have eased this. I really need to check into that. But there for a while, they made it a requirement that you couldn't release a game. Let's say, use the Apple TV as an example, where you have the remote. If you've tried to use the remote for a lot of those games, except for things like Alto's Adventure and stuff like that, it's really...
Crossy Road is the one I remember. Crossy Road and the Rocket.
Yes. I know the one you mean. Sometimes it's not a good experience, but if you have a controller, it is. So I think now they can actually require a controller on the Apple TV. I think that used to not be the case. I'd have to double check, but that's why you get what you get. There's a lot of these. I think they had a requirement saying, well, if you're going to make this interface, you have to make it work so that if the person doesn't have a controller, they can still play it, which I think is kind of ridiculous. It's put it in there. It doesn't work if you don't have a controller, and then design for the best playing experience. Some of these things, to your point, don't work well with a touch interface. Grand Theft Auto, those games are on the iPad. I own them. And I think they actually work with a controller. Those are okay if you're going to use a controller. But trying to do the controller stuff while you're driving and walking around, it's not as good. It's not as playable or usable as if you were doing it on a computer or a console.
Well, let's think. I know we're down a huge rabbit hole here, but like this Nintendo Classic thing that they just released at Christmas. Why not release something like that on iOS with all those games and sell me a $40 controller to play with them?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I would be all over that. I mean, if I'm, you know, like sell me a Nintendo controller that's Bluetooth that works with all that stuff that they just released that classic box for, the processor in an iPad is probably 10 times faster, if not more, than that classic box. That classic box is basically a Pi, right? I should be on Kickstarter with this stuff.
More. Way more.
Hell yeah.
Or even sell like a $60 or $70 controller and sell a free app on, or have a free app on the iOS store that has 30 Nintendo games on it, and you can't play it unless you have that controller, and there's something in that controller, like a serial number or something, that unlocks the game for you to be able to play it. So they know that you've paid your license as far as that hardware, that piece of hardware you bought.
And I think this is clearly, like Brian said, this is Apple keeping a lot of this stuff from happening with their requirements for what they're going to improve in the App Store. And they want it to be a unified experience and things like that. And part of it, I understand, that's just classic Apple. But just, you know, a man can like dream about the days of youth.
So let's talk about YouTube's TV bundles. So YouTube announced this week that they're going to be bringing a skinny TV bundle for around $35 a month. So this seems kind of interesting, but also kind of limited in the way that all of the offerings are. So you're going to get all the major networks. It doesn't look like you're going to get a lot in the way of your typical cable content, but at least it looks like you're going to have all of your local channels, which is a big limiting factor for things like DirecTV and Vue and Dish right now. So that's going to be a differentiator. You get an unlimited cloud-based DVR, which is, again, very, very nice. But here's the rub. So in not getting those cable channels, you know, broadcast TV has kind of been on the decline. The quality of shows and things that you get aren't really that great compared to their cable counterparts.
Kinda.
Majorly on the decline. You know, there's a lot of pre-existing deals in place for sports in terms of retransmission. So just like I ran into with Dish when I tried to watch NFL on my phone, it's like, well, you can't do that with Dish because even though you can get your Fox affiliate, Verizon has the exclusive broadcast rights for NFL on handheld, and it knows you're on a phone, so it won't let you watch it. You know, there's all these little things that are still going to make it not quite what it needs to be. And are you guys excited about this? What are your thoughts on it?
I think it's a concept that could build momentum. I think out of the gate, just the initial offerings that they're doing with the big four broadcasters is pretty cool, especially for the people who may have cut the cord and they're not subscribing to a service like DirecTV Now or PlayStation Vue or something, just because they didn't want to drop the $50 or $60 cash it requires to get one of the bigger packages. But to me, $35 seems sort of steep for those four broadcast networks.
Well, you also get ESPN and some regional sports stuff too. So you are getting more than just that, but it's not much more.
The cloud DVR is pretty cool too. You don't get that with the other services. You do get some on demand with some of the other services though.
You actually do get a cloud DVR with Vue. I use it all the time. You tell it which shows that you like to watch.
No kidding.
Yeah, and then when the time has passed and you go back to watch the old one, it'll say, do you want to watch it on demand or do you want to use your cloud DVR? Always pick the cloud DVR because you can skip the commercials with that. With on demand, you can't.
I totally overlooked that. I don't know how I missed that.
So for me, the two big points, selling points for this YouTube thing are, number one, exactly like y'all said, that cloud DVR sounds like a very nice thing to have that I wish DirecTV Now had. And I'm hoping that because of this, it might force them into doing something like that. That said, the second point that I think is good about YouTube TV is they have a very mature platform to broadcast this information to you on. You're not going to have things going down. You're not going to have...
Over differing bandwidth, too.
Yeah, over differing bandwidths. You know, it's a very mature video platform, whereas that's been the major issue for me, and I think a lot of other people with DirecTV Now, is it's been buggy at the start. When they have had high demand moments, there's been problems. I know I had problems during the NFL playoffs a little bit, you know, on the Saturday and Sunday playoff games. Sometimes they would quit on me and I could just start it right back up. It wasn't, for me at least, it was never just down. It would just crash, or sometimes it would just stop streaming and all I would have to do is quit the app on Apple TV and I could go right back in it and it would start back up and it would play just fine until it crashed again, you know, but it wasn't like over and over again right after one another. It might take 30 minutes for it to happen again or something like that. So those two things I think are pretty nice. I'm just kind of hoping just keep throwing all of these services out there, because I think it makes all of the services better, because they're going to have to try to match up on features. Just like with Sprint and T-Mobile, they had unlimited plans forever. And then finally, Verizon had to jump into that ring. And no sooner than Verizon jumped into that ring, AT&T had to jump in that ring. So this is, I think, going to be the same kind of thing, where as people obviously switch from a wired TV service come into their house via some wire from a pole, and they start getting it still through a wire from, you know, a pole, might be fiber, you know, that they're streaming these services. As they add more and more features that make them feature comparable with what you can get from a, you know, a TiVo service. Like, why TiVo hasn't come out with their own service just like this on their own and call it the TiVo TV service, where you get all of the features of a TiVo, which still is the unquestioned best DVR as far as quality and configurability and things like that. Down, you know, they've still got the best one going, but hardly nobody uses it anymore because they charge you an exorbitant amount of money just to have their DVR running on your house on top of your existing cable. I just think as more and more of these services join the fray, it's only going to get better for consumers because they're going to have to start matching on features. I would definitely look into trying this YouTube TV versus DirecTV Now and, you know, doing some sort of trial to see which one I like best and then just going with one or the other. Because I'm thinking about canceling my DirecTV Now until the fall anyway, because until football is back on, I think Hulu will do everything I need until the fall, and then I'll turn DirecTV back on.
The real reason TiVo is irrelevant, if we can get off on this tangent for a moment, is it died when we moved from analog to digital cable, honestly. That was the big deal. So if you have a satellite, if you like Dish or DirecTV on satellite, try making that work with a TiVo and let me know how that works out for you, because you can't plug it directly in. Then they all bundle DVRs in. It's the same reason you don't see small ISPs anymore, right? There's no real reason for that to exist because the defaults are good enough for everybody. It's the Apple Music phenomenon, right?
Totally agree.
Why am I going to go out and buy Spotify? I saw this week, one of the people I went to high school with took a survey of amongst their friends. They were like, should I do Spotify or should I do Apple Music? I have an iPhone. And more than one response was, well, just do Apple Music. It's already built into your phone. It's like, it doesn't matter that it's two clicks away. You can get Spotify and it's the same price. No, no, no. It was, well, it's already built into your phone. You already have it. Just go in here and do this and it's there. Same thing. Dish and DirecTV never played well with TiVo. Back in the day, I actually did have one of those IR blasters and you do the little weird thing where you're doing composite video out. Like, I made it work, not worth the trouble. And unless you had cable card, which we discussed last week, if you had a cable, making it work with TiVo, that was still a nightmare. Like, the content providers pretty much choked TiVo out.
I think the other issue that happened along the same times is when they switched to digital and when we switched to high def, hard drives didn't catch up. So you went from having a 200-hour TiVo for analog TV to a 30-hour TiVo for the same price or more, because this hard drive in it was massive, but it could still only store 30 hours of high def TV because the data was so much bigger. And, you know, all of that's finally caught up, but in that time they've become, like you said, basically irrelevant.
And there's a couple other things that made that difficult too. If you wanted to have a cloud-based DVR, now TiVo could have potentially offered that or some competitor, but again, people's internet wasn't really that fast. Having cloud storage that could keep up with it wasn't where it is today. And I think Cablevision out of New York was the first one to offer an on-demand DVR service, and they got sued immediately by the content providers, and they had to fight it, saying, you know, this is no different than having a DVR in your house where we're allowing you to time shift stuff that you are already paying for access to. This is legal. But every time something comes out like that too, there's always a flurry of initial legal action where something has to be declared okay. The content providers are really, you can usually lay it at their feet as to why this stuff doesn't get a lot of traction. But the thing is, I've been using this Plex DVR that's still in beta, and I'm to the point now, for me, my test shows, I've been sort of beta testing it myself with the superhero shows on the CW. The day after they air, so the morning after, when I come back from the gym and I need to watch something while I'm eating breakfast, I have the commercials automatically cut out overnight that does the transcoding and produces this wonderful file. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't miss this at all. And that's just off broadcast, but still so phenomenal. Loving it. All right, moving along.
One more thing there. Who else thinks that it's inevitable that Amazon Prime gets into this game and eventually you're going to be able to have a TV service built into your Prime with all this stuff that goes along with it? I mean, I just...
They're already doing it. HBO, you can get your HBO subscription, your Showtime subscription, your CISO subscription.
I think maybe what he's talking about is having an online DVR, which they already have the storage to back all of it.
Online DVR with, you know, the networks and ESPN and all that, you know, like just this exact kind of plan that DirecTV or YouTube's trying to offer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That, you know, they try to bundle in with Prime somehow. I just think that's got to be coming.
course, if you have the fat finger error that like they had earlier this week, instead of the internet going down, no one can watch TV either.
Yeah, that AWS was quite a problem going down this week. So let's see what else is going on. Tim Cook said this week on a Q&A during a shareholder meeting that you will see us do more in the pro area. So it's a good time to point out it's been over 1,100 days without a Mac Pro refresh, over 500 days since the last iMac refresh, and over 860 days since the last Mac Mini refresh. So I'm not really sure when that timetable is, but since you have, in some cases, 4 years have gone by without the top-of-the-line computer being refreshed, I don't know. Do these words ring hollow to you, or...
I just kind of take it with a grain of salt, simply because it seems like they shift one way for 5 years and they just want to go with consumer market and saturation, and that's why they sell a billion iPhones every year, and maybe that's why the pro level stuff has dropped off. And maybe they're just saying it because they have the two iPad Pros out now. It just seems kind of weird that they're not going to do something that may appeal to the masses like that.
I guess I knew these numbers, but when I looked at the show notes that Brian put together for us on this, I was shocked. I mean, 1,100 days for a Mac Pro, 500 for an iMac, which that really shocked me. That even though it's the lowest of the three, you know, the iMacs are actually popular. And then the Mac Mini, 860 days.
So Brian, you're saying that you've had your iMac for 500 days.
I have not had my iMac for 500 days. I got it in
Because yours is one model newer than mine.
It is. It's 500 days old in terms of the specs that are on it. However, I did not get mine until December of 2015, toward the end of December 2015. So I've barely had it about 15 months.
Yeah, that's crazy that I mean, those numbers, seeing them in front of me, 1,100 days for a Mac Pro. Last weekend, we were walking through an Apple store, just like you do. I know what it was. I went in because I wanted to get an HDMI plug for my iPad Pro so I could hook it up to the TV in the hotel room. So I went in there to get that plug. We walked by the Mac Pro, and they have one Mac Pro sitting in the whole store. And I was explaining to my girlfriend, you know, I'm like, this is their pro computer. And she's looking at it like, you know, it's something alien. And I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, it's been out for a couple of years now, and they really haven't done anything with it. But this is like what they sold for, you know, professional videographers and things like that. I mean, it looks awesome, and the tech is amazing, but they've kind of just let it sit there. And it's just, it's so lonely over there all by itself, just kind of sitting there, this pretty little computer that, you know,
he's the stinky kid at school.
You got to think they don't sell not even one of them a week in the stores.
They've never been big sellers is the thing. They've never sold a lot of them. But the fact that they don't do spec bumps on these things periodically, like you would have to think that in the 4 years, it was the spring of 2013 when this thing came out. You know, every year or two, how about we just bump the CPU specs or change the bus, you know, keep the form factor the same, do something.
Well, we know that Xeon processors change faster than that, so there's no reason why they couldn't at least bump processors and increase memory timing.
And the prices haven't come down at all, right? I mean, it's the exact same. It's not like they're saying we're selling you old technology, so we're going to drop the price by $1,000. The prices are exactly the same as when they came out. Yet, who's even making the processors and the graphics cards that they're putting in there, because nobody else is building new computers with those in it?
I imagine they have a lot of inventory that just hasn't sold over that time. That's a great question, though. I mean, if it breaks and it's under Apple Care and you send it back, what are they going to replace it with? I don't know. It seems odd to me. I mean, I don't doubt that they have things in the pipeline, but that's really a long time. I mean, they can say all day long that they don't hate the Mac and that it's not dying and it's still a priority, but these numbers really seem to indicate if it is a priority, it's a strange priority. It's not a high priority. And, you know, with GPU power rapidly evolving and Macs have never had high-end graphic cards, this is a big issue going forward. They have to have something. It can't always be tied to dongles and peripherals. You can't always do that. You're going to need something.
It's like Apple doesn't want to make a computer /tablet/phone that doesn't have a battery in it. Like anything that doesn't have a battery in it, they've avoided touching besides the Apple TV for the last 2 to 3 years. I mean, anything that doesn't run off a battery, they ignored.
My iMac is still pretty snappy, even for being 500 days old. Of course, I maxed mine out when I bought it. I got the highest specs on that. I didn't take the one off the shelf. So
same here.
I'm sure, you know, they're all still fast. I mean, the 13-inch MacBook that I had, that was bought in December of 2014, was still plenty fast enough for anything I really wanted to do with it. The only issue is I wanted the bigger screen. And so I was just waiting for the new MacBooks to come out, waiting. And they, you know, they finally released in November, because even those had been not touched for over a year when the new MacBook Pros came out. So no, I have no doubt that, you know, they're releasing things that are still pretty snappy and fast, but they could be a whole lot faster. I mean, we definitely with the Mac Pro or iMac, the processors that they're selling in other computers from, you know, Dell and Lenovo and things are much faster. And that's actually they're advertising against that now, saying, hey, look, you know, you're buying this Porsche, but it's got a Volkswagen engine in it compared to what's in our Ford with a Ferrari engine in it. So
well, that also depends too on the use case. And normal modern consumer level products, this isn't really a big deal. If HP is going and saying our laptop is faster than a MacBook, I would say, well, faster for what, right? If the average person is using Outlook and web browsing, I would say that a Mac is still plenty fine, right? Comparing macOS to Windows has never been like an apples to apples, pardon the pun, comparison. However, when you get into the high end, when you get into video rendering, those types of things, that's where it becomes more obvious. You've never seen Apple jump on the highest end right out of the gate. So if you look at the phones, a lot of Samsung phones, a lot of LG phones will have OLED or, you know, fast charging or something else before Apple does it, because Apple only releases one phone a year or one set of phones a year.
Or they just, whatever they implement, they want to get it right. They want to try to get it right out of the gate.
I think the issue with Apple on those type things is they have to produce things in such quantities over what Samsung or anybody else is doing. Samsung's making a lot of phones, but they're all different phones, and they're not making that many of their highest end phones immediately when they first come out. With Apple, anything they do as far as, take that back. iPhones, when they release an iPhone, or I think with the MacBooks too, with the number of people buying them, they've got to know that they're going to be able to have the quantity and the quality of parts that they need to put in these things in just massive numbers that nobody else can even fathom having, you know, that like the OLED displays. They probably could have done it, and now they might do it on this super high-end iPhone Pro model, if that's what happens, where they can ease it into the line, where everybody's not buying these OLED ones, because they might not be able to produce enough to have enough of those screens for everybody that wants one. So they release it in a pro line, and then eventually it works its way down into all the phones that they have. Same concept there.
The difference is too, is that you're guaranteed pretty much, at least as much as anything can be guaranteed, to get a new phone every single year. They're constantly refreshing that pipeline once every 12 months. If there was some sort of release cycle with the Macs, I think people would be a lot more assured that these things would ultimately filter down and you'd get these technological advances a little bit quicker. That, I think, is one of the big differentiators. If somebody has a Samsung phone in April and it has something really cool in it, maybe I'll see it come September when it's on the iPhone, or maybe not. Maybe it may take a little bit longer, but I know that every September there's going to be a new iPhone that comes out. The longest time that we've had between iPhone releases was the 4 to the 4S, which the 4 came out in like June of 2010 or something at WWDC, and I think the 4S came out in October of 2011. That's been as long as I can remember, the longest time between phones that's been out there. But I mean, certainly when you look at the 500, 860, 1100, I don't think there's that much innovation in the PC space at all. I don't think that aside from graphics cards, you're not seeing technologies and maybe the bus speeds and things. I mean, there are things that they should be able to support spec bumps without major rewrites to macOS, I guess is what I'm saying, or major driver overhauls. So, man, I really hope that they get this figured out.
I have kind of a strange thought, and I think possibly it may be related to the form factor of the current Mac Pro, just because the one that was out before that was the giant aluminum tower, and then they squeezed it all down to solid state storage into that tiny little black silo. Maybe they decided that trying to rebuild that form factor with the sort of proprietary boards and stuff in it was not worth it.
They need to go back to the cheese grater form factor where it was expandable, which it goes against their design mentality. But again, with the Mac Pros being a niche product, essentially, that only so few people buy, sacrifice the aesthetics with the ability to swap out the hardwares. Am I going to take a graphics card that's power intensive and somehow hook it externally to a Mac Pro? No, that's ridiculous. No, nobody's going to do that. The whole reason that people buy it is to be able to extend it. It should be the one computer in the line that you can still add things to. If they get rid of that, which is of course what they've been moving to, there's one that you need to keep it for, and that would be that one. That, and make the people pay a premium for it if you want to. It's fine. People will buy it, apparently, if you you make it and it's there and it can do it.
The last corporate job I had where I was in IT, that's what I had at my desk, was the last Mac Pro that they made. And I didn't buy the top of the line. I maxed it out with RAM, but I bought the single socket, not the dual socket. But it had 6 Xeon cores and 32 gigs of RAM. I mean, it could have held more than that. I think they would have held up to 256 gigabytes of RAM, which was, of course, insane for, I mean, that would have been the fastest computer in the whole building. But I was able to put 4 giant, well, then they were, I think the biggest drive you could get was a 2 terabyte drive. So I had 4 2 terabyte drives in it in a RAID 10 array. And I was able to utilize that to be able to manipulate backups and move giant files around on the network if I needed to without tying up a server, you know, and possibly slowing something down for someone else and putting a hit on the enterprise per se.
We know that was your justification, Brad, but you just wanted that big hoss of an Apple machine.
Dude, I totally did it. And it really wasn't that expensive. I mean, I already had all my peripherals. I had a keyboard, a mouse, a giant monitor that I liked. I just needed that more capable machine. And at the time, there was no PC desktop that was comparable as far as price to power. I mean, you could buy a big Dell Precision Tower, but it would have been twice the cost of the Mac Pro.
I think the iMac being the outlier, the iMac is not going away. The iMac is going to exist. For the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro, I think a lot of people would prefer if Apple would just say they're over, like we're not making any more of them, versus just letting it sit out there and people wondering if they're going to get another one. Because if you want a Mac Mini to do something, then you're waiting for it. Or you want a Mac Pro and you're not buying something else in place of it now, like a loaded up Dell or just the existing Mac Pro. If you know that that's the one that you're going to be able to get and there's never going to be a newer one, then some people, I think, would still choose that over going and buying some big new server now. But I just, the fact that Tim Cook come out and said, look, we're doing more here, I don't think that's telling us enough. I mean, I think we need some timelines, like, you know, give us something. I honestly, I just think they would be better off if they said, we're not doing this, or you're going to see something by this date.
Well, they can't say that because Apple's always been shrouded in secrecy as far as new products go.
They ought to quit saying anything, and they should make a product announcement is what they need to do. If, you know, talk is cheap. Give us something that's tangible that we can go, okay, they clearly care about it. They want to dispel the rumors, but they have to produce something to dispel the rumors. Just saying, oh no, I swear we love it is great, but not enough.
Like it's March, you know, say, hey, 6 months in September, you're going to get a new Mac Pro. Like we're not going to tell you anything more about it, but you're going to get a new Mac Pro in September. And what they might release might be something with a slight spec bump on the CPU and a barely newer graphics card, but it's, you know, you get something new in 6 months. I just think the way they're just kind of tiptoeing around, yeah, we're going to do more, but what the hell does that actually mean is worse than not saying anything at all.
Agreed. So also Apple released a video this week that highlights HomeKit's potential. So this was a really neat video. We're going to include the link to it that gives you a good idea of some of the things that you can do with HomeKit and your interactions with Siri. I trust you guys got a chance to see that.
I haven't watched it yet. I apologize.
Yeah, I thought that was really, really cool. I just want it all.
It's really not different than the way that I use it. A lot of times you'll tell it to do this scene or do that. I mean, they had things like saying, you know, I'm home or movie time or something like that, and it would activate scenes. Mine aren't nearly as intuitively named, but I thought it was very, very well done, and I'm glad that they seem to be pushing that. They really need to get the word out of the things that they can do on a budget.
Be able to say like, hey, lady, sexy time, and like the lights go down and it turns on some booty jamming music, and yeah, that would be really awesome.
Bounce chicka wow wow.
Exactly. All the lights, like, you know, start changing colors. You got your hue lights, you know, they know to start changing to different colors. Yeah, that's not very Apple-ish, is it?
I don't think they would let that in the App Store. But no, hopefully that, again, I'm hoping by next week, Jim, you'll have something to report on your automation like we talked about in the last episode.
Yes, so we're going shopping this afternoon, so we'll see what we pick up. It may just be an Apple TV. We're going to look at some other stuff and try to decide. We're going to walk through that this morning, once we're done with the podcast and see, kind of have, you know, some things in mind. But we're starting with the Apple TV, and hopefully we might get a new router, and we may get the internet upgrade here since it's not exactly fast right now, and see where it goes from there. So see what kind of streaming services we want to add to the package, that kind of thing. Really looking forward to my trip to the Apple Store today.
So the last item I have on the list for us to discuss today is Microsoft will be adding Google Calendar support to Outlook on Mac, which is already in the beta release, I guess. And that in and of itself is kind of neat, but this is part of a bigger discussion that we had over Telegram this week about the problems that we still have in 2017 that I thought would have gone away by now. And, you know, some of those things, I discussed this with some people at work too, and you know, things like file sharing is still hard. Even though we have Dropbox, even though we have all these services, it's still more cumbersome than it needs to be. Printing. Whenever you do have to print something, for those of us that do live in corporate America or have a spouse that likes to do coupons or whatever, sometimes you'll just go, your printer will sit idle 99.99% of the time. You'll want to print something out and doesn't work. Got to go reboot the printer and then it magically works. These little weird things. Calendars is also on that list of technologies that should be really something simple. I mean, it's a technology that's almost as old as email. Not as old as email, but it should be, right? It's not a hard concept.
It should be easier than email.
It really should. And you have a standard, you have this thing that's out there, but I swear, even amongst us, sharing invites, you know, when to record the podcast becomes, you have to use a shared calendar pretty much to be able to do it. And it still stinks.
We spent 30 minutes one morning like clowns hopping out of a Volkswagen trying to get our calendars straight for recording this podcast, which is just ridiculous. And then what you mentioned about,
okay, I'm gonna send the invite. Did you get the invite? Did you
get actually had to do it over Skype, looking at each other, so I could say, did you do this? Give me confirmation that this is done, and then wait to see if it repopulated into our calendar clients. And it's nuts. It should not be like
that. You mentioned printer sharing, and I've got a great story there. So the company I'm working for now, huge company, the office we're in, your first day on site, they hand you an onboarding document with all these different things you have to do to get set up to be working at this company. I'm able to connect to Teradata. I'm able to connect to Informatica. I'm able to connect to my email there on site. I'm able to connect to SharePoint. I'm able to do everything I need to do. The single hardest thing to get working in the whole place is adding a local printer, or you know, a shared network printer on my computer at this site. It was a ridiculous jumping through hoops on Windows. You've got to get logged into this print server first, and then know the IP address of the printer you're wanting to add and roughly the kind of printer it is, because Windows can't tell, or they don't have it set up right to where it can tell. So you've got to walk out, and I print out like the system information sheet from the printer. So I've got the IP and the model number. And so I get the driver, so I have the right INF file. And so now, having set it up for myself, I instantly become the office expert. And anytime we hire anybody new or somebody that's never done it before, because it was too big a pain in the butt to do when they got there, it's like, I'm like, you know, everybody's like, I need a printer. And they're like, ask Jim, you know.
Jim's the DBA, but he knows how to work the printer.
Ask Jim. Jim's the guy. Yeah, exactly. I'm the guy that, you know, I'm writing code, you know, in the database all day. And oh yeah, can you come set up my printer? Because it's an effing nightmare. I mean, that's just the simplest way to put it.
At my previous job, just a dog pile on this, it was the same thing. The printers never had a name that were intuitive. They always looked like some serial number. You always had to get that stupid driver. You had to get the one that was on the floor that you were on as well. And God help you if you got specially approved to get a Mac in this place and then had to go through all of that Windows-centric hell on your Mac to get. I think I gave up on printing at my previous job because of that. But in my house, what I've done, and again, as I've moved all of my relatives, anyone who depends on me for tech support, I've moved to the Mac or the iOS. At least AirPrint has been a great idea in theory, because with the Bonjour protocol, you know, with your iPad, your iPhone, I know it's at least going to see the printer. The printer may need to be periodically restarted. Okay, fair enough. That sucks, but it is what it is. But at least that makes things easier, right? And as I've gotten everyone away from Windows, I know that they're going to be able to print. It's not going to be a problem. There's no special hoops to jump through. Printer that's behind me here has been the best printer that I've had. And even it still has issues every now and again with the, you know, need to reboot it once every 3 months or something. But
I guess I'm going to shoot myself in the foot here, but I just don't have the printer issues that y'all have. I mean, I have two kids, and they're one's in college, one's in high school, and they print a lot. I mean, always typing up papers and stuff. And I'm not going to say my printer sits idle a whole lot, but it does sit idle a good bit. But I never have to restart it, knock wood. I know I just banged on the table, but seriously, like, I really don't have that problem. Whereas I'm not mixing Windows and Mac here. We are totally Mac in my home. So maybe that's the difference.
That's the key, Brad. My home printer, I don't have a lot of problems with. I have a Brother laser printer, one of those cheapy 60 bucks, if that, off Amazon Brother laser printers that's recommended on the Wirecutter. You know, it just works at home. And actually now I have my old MacBook sitting there as kind of a server. So I actually plug the printer into that and I'm using that as my print server and I can print from that. It was even reasonably easy to set it up to print from Windows. Once I figured it out, you know, it wasn't difficult. But in an enterprise environment, how a printer can be harder than connecting to the enterprise database just to me is nuts.
I will second that. Something that should be simple that isn't. And I think I print postage more than I print anything else when I'm sending stuff to different people. It's probably my biggest use case, and my wife doing coupons every now and again.
I think my biggest use case is concert tickets for the ones where I still can't get in with my phone. So I'm printing out concert tickets.
I had hoped by 2017 to never need a printer again. But again, the real thing that we're complaining about here are calendars. And I had to, we've noticed, we got to talking this week that Fantastical, which excellent calendaring program, love it, own it on all my devices, hook it in with Exchange. And sometimes people at work will delete a meeting and I'll still get the reminder from Fantastical, hey, you've got this meeting in 10 minutes. And I can't delete it from Fantastical. That's the thing. If I had to go in and manually delete something that disappeared from Outlook, I would even go through that trouble. No, I can't get rid of it. There's no delete.
Well, you can't delete it because you didn't create.
Well, there's no delete option. Well, in Outlook, I can.
You have to decline the meeting. You have to decline the meeting. And if you do that, it sends a message to whoever created the meeting that you declined it when you didn't really decline it. It moved, but it's still on your damn calendar.
In Outlook, you can delete stuff without declining it. You can say that I'm sending the organizer a thing that you deleted it or no. And I usually just say no if I don't want them to know that I deleted it. But you don't get that option in Fantastical, right? It's not just because you didn't create it. It's I should be able to delete anything off my calendar that I want to, regardless of who created it. I can't delete it, period. So that's kind of a problem.
So you think that's an Exchange API thing, maybe? Maybe not Fastaccount. Maybe it's something that you can't do within the API that it extends out to external calendars, maybe?
Well, I think the real issue is if something happens inside of Exchange, it should get that update and delete it, right? That's the thing. It should disappear off the calendar. So I did open a ticket this week. They did say, is this happening in Apple's calendar program as well? And honestly, I don't know because I don't use Apple's calendar program. So I got to respond and say, well, the next time it happens, I'll open up the calendar program and double check. I don't know what that has to do with anything, but we'll take a look and see. But again, this is one of those things that it should be a lot easier than what it is. I don't know if the problem's Exchange. I don't know if the problem, we see it in our own iCal calendars we share with each other through events. So I'm tempted to think that it's probably not, but I don't know. It's very frustrating and it's something that I wish we had solved by now as technologists.
Does Fantastical exist solely on top of iCal, where if it's not in iCal, it's not in Fantastical? Or can you actually have things in Fantastical that aren't in iCal? Is it just a new interface to do everything that's inside of iCal, or can it actually have accounts that aren't in the other? I'm actually not sure about that.
I'll double check. I'm not sure either. I think that it exists on top of, you know, it can handle all those different formats. It seems like it would be like a weird thing for them to write and maintain when there's so many things that you have out there already. This may be a case where Google's calendar is just better. I don't know if there's anyone listening that has a strong opinion on Google's calendar, let us know. Because at this point, I may just be ready to just throw my hands up and ditch, iCal if it doesn't get any better. But I'd hate to do that. But, you know, it is what it is. So
one of the things I hate dealing with is, so being a consultant, I have email and a calendar for my client that I'm working. And then I also have an Outlook, Exchange account for my company. And so to keep my calendars in sync, if I get an invite on the client I'm working at's calendar, I always end up going back and putting a placeholder on my other calendar. So that time is blocked out. So, or vice versa. So that way, since you can't see both calendars from when somebody's trying to schedule me, it would be really nice in Outlook where you could say, hey, if I have a time block on this calendar, just block it out on the other one as, not available or something. That would be really nice.
Universal free busy should be something that was implemented a long time ago. I go through the same thing. So right now I'm doing physical therapy. And instead of putting that on my personal calendar where it belongs, I put it on my work's Exchange calendar and mark myself out of office so that, somebody doesn't try to to schedule a meeting or a phone call over a time when I'm not going to be available. It forces me to use my Exchange calendar as a personal calendar in that regard, and I don't like that.
I have out of office set on my personal calendar for my flight times, my company calendar for my flight times, and my client calendar for my flight times. So that way I don't end up with any meeting schedule for early Monday afternoon or Monday morning or late Thursday afternoon when I'm, you know, always in the air. So I have to set it on all three so I can kind of see what's going on. Just another simple thing that should exist that, you know, for whatever reason, calendars should be easier. We've mastered email. We've got, you know, Facebook that can do all these amazing things and Twitter and everything else. And, you know, everybody just ignored the simple calendar.
That's all I have for this week. I think we covered everything I wanted to talk about. Do you guys have anything you want to mention before we call it done?
Nothing here. Just everybody have a good week, and hopefully we'll hear some more good iPhone rumors this week for this fall. That's it for me.
All right. Until next time. Later, fellas.
Later, fellas.
Later, fellas.
Please visit infiniteloopback.com for show notes and previous episodes. You can find us on Twitter. The Twitter handle for the show is @infinloopback. That's @infinloopback. I am @BrianB. That's @BrianB. Jim is @BigJim. That's @BigJim. And Brad is @MeesterIdle. That's @MeesterIdle. Thanks for listening, and we hope to talk to you next time.